Qatar. You can also find us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for listening. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
Official told Reuters last week that the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken signed on Tuesday, June 18, a new exemption related to national security that allows Iraq to pay the cost of electricity to Iran and allows for the first time to deposit payments in non-Iraqi bank accounts. Yes, you heard that right. The U.S., which denies having any influence in politics and economic and financial affairs for Iraq, has officially allowed Iraq, a sovereign state, to pay off energy debt to another sovereign state, being the Islamic Republic of Iran. The official, who spoke on condition that his name and position not be disclosed, added that the United States hopes that the 100-day waiver will help ease Iranian pressures on Iraq to obtain funds that previously could only be deposited in restricted accounts inside Iraq. Iraq has now been granted green light by the U.S. authorities to pay about $2.76 billion of its gas and electricity debt to Iran after receiving this U.S. sanctions waiver. The Iraqi government was deeply embarrassed by its inability to fulfill its promise to secure electric power during the months of July and August, which are the hottest months of the year in the country, which prompted popular and political circles to blame it for the continuation of this crisis. However, the coordinating framework supporting the Iraqi government held Washington responsible for the return of the electricity crisis due to its refusal to allow Baghdad to pay for Iranian gas. The agreement signed between Iraq and Iran on July 11th of this year came to exchange Iranian gas for Iraqi oil as a way to avoid U.S. sanctions to open the way for resolving one part of this crisis. Iran had reduced its gas exports to Iraq by more than 50% as of the 1st of July, after Baghdad was unable to obtain the approval of the United States of America to disperse the money owed to Iran. Iraq imports electricity and gas from Iran, which together make up between 33% and 40% of its energy supplies, especially in the scorching summer months when temperatures reach 50 degrees Celsius and energy consumption peaks. Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani had previously announced that Iraq owes Iran about 11 billion euros, but is having difficulty repaying these debts due to U.S. sanctions that only allow Tehran to obtain funds to purchase non-sanctioned goods, such as food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Parliamentary Electricity and Energy Committee called on the Iraqi government to put pressure on the United States of America to remove the energy file from political calculations, while the coordinating framework called on Washington to release dues for Iranian gas imports in order to avoid the negative repercussions of the crisis on the Iraqi citizen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken signed a new national security waiver allowing Iraq to pay Iran for electricity by depositing payments into non-Iraqi bank accounts. The U.S. exemption extends to 120 days, claiming that non-Iraqi banks will need to obtain U.S. permission to disperse funds that will be directed only for humanitarian purposes. Under U.S. punitive measures, Iraq's payments for Iranian electricity can only be dispersed from accounts registered inside Iraq and with U.S. permission, supposedly for Iran to purchase its humanitarian needs. To discuss this issue with us from Baghdad is Dr. Safwan Qusay, professor of economics at the University of Baghdad and expert in Iraqi economics. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Safwan. Now, due to decades of conflicts and sanctions, Iraq is dependent on imports from Iran for a lot of its gas needs. However, we have seen that U.S. sanctions on the Iranian oil and gas industry have hampered Iraq's payments for its imports, putting it in a very heavy debt for its neighbor. Yet, in mid-June, Iraq got a U.S. approval to clear $2.76 billion U.S. dollars gas debt to Iran. Now, if Iraq had paid in due time, it wouldn't have accumulated that much money to be paid in a lump sum at one period of time. How is Iraq expected to survive financially with such blatant U.S. sanctions?
It is clear that Iraq definitely needs electricity and gas, especially in the summer. However, the process of financial regulation between Iraq and the payment of these dues requires a financial agreement under the supervision of the U.S. Treasury in order for there to be a flow of financial transfers either directly or through the restricted account in favor of the purchase of humanitarian and non-human goods in Iran. Practically, the Iraqi delay in approving the budget for the year 2023 contributed to the difficulty of paying these dues at the appropriate times. Nevertheless, currently the joint account within the Trade Bank of Iraq contains sufficient funds to pay these dues. Of course, the United States of America needs permission from the U.S. Treasury in order for these dues to be paid. However, it seems that they have credited these amounts to a non-national bank so that the payment through this account will be for Iran's needs and under the supervision of the United States of America.
Well, according to media reports, we did see that both Tehran and Baghdad have found several solutions to receive the Iranian money from the Central Bank of Iraq itself, which is basically not allowed by the U.S. But Iraq's outstanding payments to Iran will be cleared gradually as per this new agreement within the next 3 to 5 or 6 months. But the U.S. waiver for Iraq is only for 120 days. Will Iraq be able to make this payment within this short period of time if it is not allowed to make it from within its own banks?
Of course, Iraq owns bank accounts and has sufficient funds to pay dues within letters of credit. But the problem is with the U.S. sanctions. If the Iraqi Central Bank Administration succeeded in setting up a financial mechanism to be an alternative to the direct transfer process, as Europe does, then certainly this agreement could contribute to transferring funds within a period of 120 days or less. Because this account could be placed within the Europeans' agreement with Iran, and there would be funds that Iran could make use of in importing at the level of European companies. The request of Iraq to join this European, basically German, French, and even British trade agreement with the Iranians could contribute to the transfer of funds and thus become at the disposal of the Iranian side in purchasing items that the Iranian people deserve through this account.
Do you think that the U.S. will allow such an inclusion of Iraq in this agreement?
In my opinion, we have to turn illegal trade into legal trade. The volume of trade exchange now between Iraq and Iran is more than $10 billion annually. Certainly, all operations carried out by Iraqi banks, directly or indirectly, or purchasing dollars from the parallel market are supposed to be under a clear system of circulation. I think such a request is supposed to be met with justice from the American side. Just as the Europeans were allowed to proceed with this agreement, the Iraqis and Emiratis can also be included under this umbrella in order to remove sanctions from Iraqi banks or Emirati companies, for example. The Americans claim that they are not against the interests of the Iranian people, and this agreement can be used for the benefit of the Iranian people. Thus, we will create a sustainable trade mechanism away from U.S. sanctions.
Well, I want to discuss with you the internal Iraqi crisis of energy. It baffles me really that a resourceful country like Iraq is yet to build its own power plant, despite the U.S. promise to do so after it destroyed the infrastructure of the country after the aftermath of the 2003 invasion. I mean, maybe a nuclear power plant would cost Iraq slightly more than its current debt for Iran. That's one nuclear power plant, and would solve the entire problem, or at least maybe 80% of that problem. What stops Iraq from pursuing this, doing this kind of solution for the Iraqi people?
The electric power sector was destroyed in 1991 and rehabilitated after 2003 with the increase in energy demand and population growth. Yes, there were efforts by previous governments and also the current government to conclude contracts at the level of investment in establishing new stations, investing in solar energy, electric power, and investing in associated gas to generate electricity by relying on Iraqi gas. Projects already exist with the solid companies like that of General Electric, Siemens, or Francis Total, but this issue takes time. In my opinion, energy security in Iraq is monitored by the government, and we are trying to meet local demand through Iraqi stations. The issue of purchasing a nuclear power plant, in my opinion, yes, is an option. The National Investment Commission is now able, with its money and vision, to buy ready-made stations, whether in Turkey, the Kingdom of Jordan, or even Egypt, where the production of these stations be in the service of Iraq. Currently, Iraq is seeking to link to the Persian Gulf and to be a transit point for energy between the Gulf and the European Union. We are witnessing governmental efforts in this direction, and we will have stability in energy. But the matter takes time, so we are currently in dire urgency to continue importing energy from the Iranian side, whether electricity or gas, until we have the capability to rely on Iraqi resources.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Safwan Qusay, Professor of Economics at the University of Baghdad and expert in Iraqi economics, for joining us to discuss this new matter of giving for the Iraqi government to pay its debt for the Iranian government. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the U.S. sanctioning 14 Iraqi banks.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The United States imposed sanctions on 14 Iraqi banks, according to an American Wall Street Journal report last week, quoting U.S. officials explaining that the punitive measures prevent these banks from conducting transactions in dollars as part of a comprehensive campaign to transfer U.S. dollars to Iran. This is not the first time that the U.S. Treasury Department has imposed sanctions and restrictions on Iraqi banks as part of an attempt to surround and curb financial flows from banks in Iraq to the Islamic Republic of Iran. More details in the following report.
The United States of America imposed sanctions on 14 Iraqi banks, claiming that these new punitive measures prevent the Iraqi banks from conducting transactions in U.S. dollars as part of a comprehensive campaign to transfer the U.S. dollar to the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is not the first time that the U.S. Treasury Department imposes sanctions and restrictions on Iraqi banks as part of an attempt to surround and curb financial flows from banks in Iraq to Iran as part of the trade relations between the two countries. Tehran had previously accused Washington of conspiring against Iraq and held it responsible for the crisis of the collapse of the Iraqi dinar last year in return for the high exchange rate of the dollar inside Iraq, a crisis that triggered a wave of protests. Meanwhile, the sudden rise in the exchange rate of the U.S. dollar against the Iraqi dinar, which resulted mainly from restrictions imposed by the U.S. Federal Reserve in New York, had immediate economic effects in the form of a decline in business activity, a rise in the prices of imported goods, and an exacerbation of social tensions. At the heart of this crisis lies the problem of the U.S. obsession with controlling any trade Iraq conducts, especially with neighboring countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran, which the U.S. deems illegal from its own unilateral point of view. The repercussions and consequences of this financial crisis, which is the most serious since 2003, are not limited to the economic situation only, but also have geostrategic repercussions and will have a significant impact on the political power relations in Iraq. In November 2022, the Federal Reserve in New York began restricting the amount of dollars transferred to Iraq in compliance with a policy set years ago by the U.S. Treasury. In early 2020, the U.S. Treasury Department required the Iraqi government to comply with an electronic system that U.S. officials claim is intended to ensure transparency in dollar transactions, combat money laundering, and smuggle dollars into Iran, Syria, and Turkey, also known as normal trade ties with Iraqi bordering countries. As a result of these restrictions, approximately 80% of requests for dollar remittances in Iraq were rejected. As a result, the value of the dinar in the foreign exchange market declined at the end of January 2023, as the price of $1 reached 1,750 dinars, compared to an official exchange rate of 1,460 dinars. The strict U.S. monetary policy towards the Iraqi state represented an incentive for the Iraqi authorities to adopt financial and economic policies that bypasses these illogical U.S. policies and evade U.S. sanctions to avoid the negative repercussions of the crisis on the regular Iraqi citizens. On the other hand, the strict U.S. monetary policy will have a significant impact on small and medium-sized companies and enterprises, which are accustomed to using the Hawala system, which is an informal transfer system that enables these companies to avoid going through both private and public banks.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. John Andrews, author, journalist, and broadcaster specializing in world politics. He's a contributing editor for The Economist and is a head tutor for Economist Education. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Andrews. It's a pleasure to have you. Now, the United States has barred 14 Iraqi banks from conducting dollar transactions. This is what the Wall Street Journal reported last week, citing U.S. officials for that matter. Now, the ban, which was imposed by the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, is part of some sort of a crackdown on the alleged siphoning of U.S. Currency to the Islamic Republic of Iran. That came less than a month after Iraq got a U.S. approval to clear $2.7 billion in gas debt to be paid to the Islamic Republic of Iran within 120 days. So how is Iraq supposedly going to pay its debt if the U.S. less than a month later is banning Iraqi banks from conducting dollar transactions with the Islamic Republic of Iran?
That's a very good question, and there is no easy answer. I think the fact is that both Iraq and the United States and, in a sense, Iran are all trapped by what happened 20 years ago with the toppling of Saddam Hussein. I mean, the irony is that, you know, Iraq could easily pay its own way because it's got all its oil revenue. But that oil revenue, thanks to a UN Security Council resolution back in, I guess, 2003, after the toppling of Saddam, is lodged in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And that means that Iraq has to withdraw it from New York each time it needs foreign hard currency. And the problem, of course, is that Iran is subject to American sanctions, very, very tough American sanctions. So is Iran's other neighbor, Syria. And you could argue that this is a kind of it's an impediment to normal trade. But you can see where the Americans are coming from. They have sanctioned Iran in particular, ever since 1979 and the toppling of the Shah. And they also they are sanctioning Syria because of Bashar al-Assad's reaction to what was called, rather misleadingly, the Arab Spring. And so you have this kind of odd situation in which America is trying to reinforce its sanctions, trying to implement them properly, and is coming across the reality that when you have sanctions, someone is always going to be clever enough to evade those sanctions. Mm-hmm. Added to that, of course, is you have rampant corruption in Iraq. And that explains, I think, one of the problems that the Iraqi government has to deal with as well. And you know very well that some Iraqi officials were involved in all the money laundering that went on. So you can see it from both sides' point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, Iraq, by virtue of its strategic location, it finds itself stuck in a difficult situation between two rivals. We have the United States of America on one side, the Islamic Republic of Iran on the other, as it cannot satisfy its natural relations and ties with its bordering neighboring country, Iran, at the expense of more U.S. Sanctions that might come in the future. Yet Iraq depends heavily on Iran for both electricity and gas, or else it wouldn't survive. What options do you think Iraq can maneuver with in such a situation?
I think it's very, very difficult for Iraq. And I mean, as I said before, there is no easy solution. If there were, it would have been taken already. The problem is that Iraq is not going to become a clean, uncorrupt country overnight. Obviously not. I mean, this is just an endemic problem in a huge part of the world, and I'm not excluding Europe from this, nor the United States. But you can see that from America's point of view, it needs to put pressure on Iran, not least in terms of renegotiating the Iran nuclear deal, the deal that Barack Obama and the EU and China and Russia and Germany did with Iran, but which of course was torn up effectively by Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, to put pressure on Iran, it means enforcing the sanctions more and more effectively. That, of course, means that Iraq becomes between, the metaphor is always between a rock and a hard place, and you can see Iraq's plight in this. I don't really think that it can do much except to appeal to the better nature of the American administration. Now, does that
if they ever have one?
But exactly. Better nature exist. I think the only positive thing from an Iraqi point of view is that somehow I think that the American administration, regardless of whether it's Democrat or Republican, has to show that the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the invasion of Iraq had gains as well as losses, that Iraq is actually an improving country. And in many ways, of course, it is, with democratic elections and so on. Now, that means that there is a certain amount of moral suasion that Iraq can put on the administration in Washington, D.C. But, you have to bear in mind that the American government is a huge apparatus. And, the Treasury Department is one thing, the Department of Justice is another, a State Department is another. To get them all to be on the same page could be pretty difficult. And I think you need really something from the White House to really try to move the dial slightly on what is going to happen here. It's hard to see.
I completely understand where you're coming from, but it's very, very difficult for someone living in West Asia to understand why in the first place there has to be a U.S. permission for any of these ties. But Western media have clearly indicated the responsibility of Washington and the U.S. Federal Bank specifically for the current deterioration in the Iraqi dinar, and that it has obstructed Iraq from obtaining its liquid oil revenues in dollars, justifying this by smuggling large sums of money in dollars by Iraqi parties to Iran and Syria, which are also obviously subject to U.S. punitive measures. If the U.S. cares about the Iraqi economy as it claims, then is it not allowing Iraq to obtain at least its liquid oil revenues? Why are they putting a block there?
No, you make a very good point, Maduro. But the fact is that where Iraq is, where it features on the political scene in the United States, is pretty low down at the moment. I said that, you know, Iraq needs to somehow try and twist the arms of the Washington administration in terms of moral suasion. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be actually pretty difficult. I mean, all that America really cares about at the moment is actually punishing Iran in order to try to get Iran to come to some sort of deal on its nuclear program, or its alleged nuclear program, with the United States. That means that, you know, the fall guy in this is actually Iraq. Mm-hmm. And the irony, of course, is that it was the Iraqi government in the early days that agreed with this UN security resolution that the oil revenue should actually be lodged in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That's a decision which I think Iraqi government now must bitterly regret.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. John Andrews, author, journalist, and broadcaster specializing in world politics, and a contributing editor for The Economist and a head tutor for Economist Education, it's such a pleasure to have you on the Middle Stream with us to discuss this pressing issue on the entire Iraqi map, not only on the Iraqi economic spectrum, but also politics and elsewhere. I would thank you very much for your contribution and your time. And ladies and gents, we are going to bring you the hottest topics from West Asia to your doorstep, basically. We'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
In Eurozone, expectations for core inflation have been shattered as costs in the service sector grow. Core inflation in the Euro area accelerated and stayed stubbornly high in June, a preliminary reading revealed recently. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, head inflation in the 20 countries that share the euro hit 5.5% this month, coming in slightly lower than analyst projections. But core inflation, which excludes energy and food, remains high and surged to 5.4% as price growth in the service sector also rose to 5.4%, up from 5% recorded in April. The core rate is likely to remain well above the 5% mark in the next month, which will require further rate hikes by ECB, said Ulrich Kaestens, an economist for Europe at WDS. Although the Eurozone's core inflation eased somewhat from 5.6% in April to 5.3% in May, the latest deterioration may eclipse an improvement in the headline inflation gauge, economists warn. Maiva Kazin, Bloomberg's senior economist, also said, base effects and statistical distortions are likely to keep the core reading elevated over the next couple of months and see the ECB hiking at least until September. Consumer price growth will be closely monitored by the European Central Bank, which hiked interest rates to their highest level in 22 years on June 5th. The regulator moved the benchmark rate by 25 basis points to 4% in a ninth consecutive rate hike. According to the Federal Statistical Office, the Statis, inflation in Eurozone's leading economy, Germany, also hit 6.4% in June in annual terms, its first rise since February. According to preliminary data, the figure was up from 6.1% in the previous month. When harmonized to compare with other EU countries, Germany's inflation rate in June was 6.8% year-on-year. Food prices have continued to show above-average growth in June compared with the same month of last year. According to Die Statis, they rose 13.7%, increasing the burden on struggling consumers. Energy prices were up 3% in June on an annual basis. According to the report, the federal government third relief package has contributed to the slowing of the energy price increase. The German Council of Economic Experts, GCEE, earlier warned that inflation in the country could remain high for longer than expected or even accelerate if monetary policy measures are offset by risks in financial markets. The GCEE said it expects an average inflation rate of 6.6% in 2023. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank, ECB, has hiked interest rates to an unprecedented 4% in an attempt to combat high inflation. ECB President Christine Lagarde has said recently that a further rate increase in July was very likely. The German economy, once Europe's roaring engine of growth, slipped into recession in early 2023 amid runaway inflation, the National Statistics Office revealed recently. GDP data is reportedly showing surprisingly negative signals, with the economy losing the potential for growth. RT looks at the challenges facing the EU's economic powerhouse, including why is Germany's recession important? The EU's largest and richest member, Germany, has built its economic power on its manufacturing capacity, its integration into international trade, and a strong transport and logistics ecosystem. It is the world's fifth largest economy in terms of PPP, behind China, the US, India, and Japan. So, what is crippling the EU's economic titan? Post-pandemic supply chain problems and trade disputes, along with the energy crisis and aggressive monetary policy tightening, have all placed a strain on the export-oriented German economy. Industrial production has stalled amid geopolitical tensions, supply bottlenecks, and a shift to green energy. That was followed by a drop in purchasing power and diminished industrial orders. What's the major challenge for Berlin? The most important issue for the government is to sustainably serve the energy needs of the country's industrial base amid the green transition. Germany is one of the world's leading industrial nations, and manufacturing accounts for about a fifth of the economy, which for decades relied on cheap Russian energy to grow. So what has the impact been of sanctions and the energy crisis? Among EU members, Germany has been the hardest hit by the side effects of Western sanctions on Russia, as flows of Russian natural gas have dwindled significantly. The sabotage on the Nord Stream pipeline, one of the main routes for Russian gas to Europe, has added to the woes. As a result, Germany no longer receives gas directly from Russia, having previously imported more than 50% of its blue fuel from the country. Meanwhile, European wholesale energy prices reached unprecedented levels in 2022 as a result of sanctions on Russia, prompting fears of deindustrialization, particularly in Germany. So, what other risks threaten Europe's leading economy? As a hub for industry, Germany is facing huge technological and political challenges. A lack of qualified workers is another major problem, forcing Berlin to further liberalize immigration. A recent study by the German Economy Institute showed that industries had more than 630,000 open vacancies for qualified workers they could not fill in 2022, up from 280,000 a year before. Is the EU's green energy push helpful? German manufacturers have been struggling to produce cars and factory equipment because of parts and labor shortages, as well as surging energy prices. However, they are being forced to invest hundreds of billions of euros over the coming years to meet the bloc's new clean energy standards. The nation's automotive industry, by far the biggest in Europe, used to support hundreds of thousands of German jobs and account for over 20% of the nation's overall economic output. However, demand for German cars has been in decline amid the global shift toward electric vehicles. Economists are predicting that the industrial sector, which has been the pillar of the German economy, will remain stagnant this year instead of the hoped-for recovery, dampening the prospects of an economic resurgence. The outlook is grim, as the transition to affordable renewable power could still take years, experts say. The German economy, formerly a reliable engine for pulling the European Union out of crises, has turned into its weak link. Economists see German growth lagging behind the rest of the region for years to come, while the International Monetary Fund has forecast it will be the worst performing G7 economy this year.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences sorrow and sadness for the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws regarding the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, or in commemoration of his martyrdom, and also Arba'in. Well, before that, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'll be back. Don't go away. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years.
At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the Islamic laws about Muharram, and which the martyrdom of the grandson of the Holy Prophet, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, has taken place. Sheikh Tawid, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. Is there any problem or objection in using certain expressions which might remind us of a kind of disrespect or insult to an individual? Like, for example, I'm Hussein's dog. You might hear this in some eulogies.
Sure.
Right? In the commemoration gatherings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Is there any objection to using such expressions?
Well, His Eminence says that it is advisable, not to utter such expressions. It means that it is not appropriate to use such expressions because it is degrading, it is against one's human dignity, and it is also offensive if someone else hears that, who is an outsider. He doesn't seem to understand what it means, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not appropriate for an individual to use such expressions because it is degrading in the first place. And His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that the believers should observe the standards of commemorating the demise of the or the martyrdom of the infallibles,
mm-hmm.
Especially that of the master of the martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam.
Sheikh Tawid, is it permissible for women to take part in the mourning processions where beating the chest and lashing with chains in fact happen or take place, provided that they observe hijab, the women observe hijab and wear special clothes?
Well, His Eminence says that it's not appropriate for women to take part in the processions of chest beating and lashing with chains, Because there are two points to mention. One is that men and women get mixed with each other. Sometimes men and women might even come into physical contact with each other. That's not appropriate. So Muharram is an occasion where in which we should earn as much reward, and we should focus on azadari, on chest beating, and expressing grief. But when there are women and men mixed together, then that sense of azadari probably will perish. And there is one thing more to mention, that it is not appropriate for women to take part in the processions of chest beating and lashing with chains, because some men also take off their shirts, and if not their shirts, they wear revealing clothes. So probably the ladies might end up falling into a sin which is not allowed, which is not permissible, if they take part in such gatherings.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break. And we come back. We continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the Islamic laws, or some of the jurisprudential laws, about Muharram and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Well, Sheikh Javid, what's the ruling regarding people who let themselves fall down onto the floor before they enter the shrines or holy shrines of some imams, you know, rubbing their face, for example, or chest on the ground, making it dirty sometimes, and bruising sometimes their body, or even sometimes causing it to bleed?
Well, there's no evidence whatsoever in Islamic law that may lend support to such behavior that's not considered as showing empathy and sympathy with the plight of the imams. There's no evidence whatsoever. And in addition, of course, it's not permissible if it causes serious bodily harm or actually tarnishes the image of our school of thought. It's not permissible. So I would like to mention that, okay, if some people, you know, there are people I have seen myself, they prostrate themselves when they arrive at the door of the holy shrines. And you know, prostration is for God only. Only Allah deserves to be worshipped.
Mm-hmm.
And we should not do sajda in front of the shrines or the zari or the chambers, no matter what our purpose is, because it is at least perceived or understood by other people as a kind of doing sajda in front of the imam, mm-hmm. which is not permissible. Of course.
It looks like idol worshipping.
Yeah, it looks like that. Yes, of course. So even though I'm very much sure that those people who do this, they do not intend to do sajda in front of them. They don't mean it. But they want to just respect. They just want to show respect. But even then, we should not do it because other people will take it as a kind of doing sajda in front of the imams or those noble figures.
Mm-hmm, I see. Even if they pray, I remember in one of the previous episodes you were talking about like denouncing it. Like when you even offer your prayers while prostrating and genuflecting in front of the some of the tombs of or monuments of the shrines, right?
It's not. Yeah, it's reprehensible.
Yes,
it's reprehensible to perform your prayers with a tomb or a grave in front of you.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let me ask you another question. What is the ruling in the matter of using mourning standards in the rituals or processions commemorating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, by putting it in the mosque or carrying it along with the mourners?
Well, there is, you asked about, standards, sure, yes?
Yes.
So there's no problem in doing so in and of itself, using mourning standards and so on and so forth. And this should, but this should not be perceived as part of the religious tradition, okay? It should not be perceived and should not be understood or taken as a part of the religious tradition. In and of itself, there is no problem in doing so, in using mourning standards.
Was it something that used to be done in the past, I mean, as a tradition? Or it's a modern thing or concept?
It's not a modern thing. It used to be even in let's say, a few hundred, maybe years ago, people, even in the early period of Islam, they used standards.
Mm-hmm.
Standards, there's nothing wrong with it, okay? We have narrated that, okay, they had standards, they had flags, and there was a person who was a flag bearer even in the battles. So a flag or a standard used to be there in the early period of Islam, and there is no objection to it and the present time as well. But it's not part of the religious ritual, the religious tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It can be, it cannot be. So either way, there's no objection in it.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us by listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to touch on some of the Islamic laws regarding Muharram and martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it awaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.